You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
Hello, this is Mike Silverblatt, and welcome to Bookworm. Today I'm talking to John Sanford, the author, among other books, of The Winters of That Country, To Feed Their Hopes, View from the Wilderness, A More Goodly Country, and five volumes of autobiography, The Color of the Air, The Waters of Darkness, A Very Good Land to Fall With, A Walk in the Fire, and The Season It Was Winter. I'm here in his house in Santa Barbara, a very rare occasion for me. I was introduced to his work. It seems to me to be work of great quality. And I've made really my only trip outside the studio this year to come and talk to him. He is 89 years old. The work is largely unknown to Americans, and yet it seems to me that it is work that is crucial, particularly to us as Americans. I'm going to begin by asking him to read a section from The Winters of That Country, a section about the bombing of Nagasaki called The Ugly Sky. This is John Sanford reading The Ugly Sky from The Winters of That Country.
The Ugly Sky deals with the bombing of Nagasaki, 1945, and the epigraph is from Dr. Takashi Nagai. As I lay there, looking up at the ugly sky, there was a faint smell of wild chrysanthemum. Alongside my cheek stood a torn, flowerless stem. He was at or near the college hospital when the bomb was dropped from a height of 30,000 feet, and all through its fall of 52 seconds, he might have been doing any of many possible things. Yet even he could not have said whether he'd been standing or seated, whether speaking or silent, gazing from a window or lighting a cigarette. He remembered a stunning blue-white flash, but nothing else. He never knew how he came to be lying in the ash of grass, looking up at the ugly sky. He was unaware of the ruinous stroke of sound, of heat that put a vitreous finish on the earth, of fire instant and everywhere, in which all that would burn turned suddenly to slag. Dogs, cats, and people became scoria, as did insects, birds in flight, and trees, but he never learned why these things died and he lived. All about him the smell of wild chrysanthemum over pinches of char. That had been an old woman once, or someone's pet, or an unknown passerby, and from such small remains a blue gas soul went up to join the ugly sky. Lying there in the carbons of the city, he couldn't recall whether he'd picked the flower that was still on the air. Nothing of the past moment, the past hour, came back to fill his mind. He watched smoke pile up from smoke, build itself by the mile, saw it spread and set the morning sun, and soon outsized drops of rain began to fall, oil black and oil cold, and without knowing why he should rise, he rose, and through unastonished eyes he took in pulverized brick, iron that fire had brought to a bubble, steel rail wrought like wire, a trolley in which a cinder driver still drove his cinder fares. His watch had stopped, and with it time, and he wandered without purpose, drifted where the wind blew or whim drew him, and he passed bodies skewered on bamboo splinters, smashed by bolts of molten metal, shredded by flying glass. In the street, a foam of dead floated among exploded fish, and tied to a boiled mother by the bob the dinghy of a premature child. Others wandered with him, naked, hairless, smeared with shit, and they held their arms free of their bursted sides, and from seared backs the skin hugged down in rags. All stared at nothing, as if there were nothing at all to see, and through open mouths they screamed without sound, pleaded for what they could not utter from those that could not hear. The flies were quick to return, or were they new ones that came to feast on pus, piss, and broken blisters, on the roasted squabs of children and the colons of the old, and when disturbed they took wing humming, winged atoms, and coming down they clambered over corpses till cooked meat looked alive. And a man with burned hand was seen to soak it in water, from which then blue smoke emerged, and when the man stooped to drink, he died. And many noted an unbearable odor, as of drying squid, and they brimmed over with vomit, a thin yellow liquid, and they passed things with their faces melt away, with nothing left but teeth. And in one such head the teeth spoke, asking for water, and children laughed as though they'd lost their minds. And there was a pumpkin field, bare of pumpkins save for one, a woman's head with a gold tooth, and her eyelids were open, but she had no eyes. And women bled from the uterus, though it was not their menses time, and there was blood and urine too, in stools and sputum, and faces were blown to double size, and at such things the mad children laughed, and at a mother giving tit to a dead infant, and walking in their own silence, screaming unheard in an unheard of hell, a host of the living would soon be dead. Indeed, for most malaise had begun, with the rays that they bore within, and even then they suffered fevers, epilation, purpura, necrosis of the gums, and already their platelets were fewer, their appetites weaker, their sperm counts nil, and it would have shaken them to know how their bones would glow in the dark. They were decaying on the go, dying in a dream of living, a scream without a sound. A smell of wild chrysanthemum, he thought, and as he roamed among the dead, it may have kept him alive. He dwelt on the broken stem he'd seen. What color had the blossom been? How lush its ruche of leaves. A smell of wild chrysanthemum, he thought. But why did he name the flower when he meant the smell of the leaves? He tried, tranced and almost airborne, to evoke their sylvan rankness, that of weeds. The more he sought it, the further it faded. Still, he kept on pursuing it, and that may be why he lasted under the ugly sky. But not forever. Dr. Nakashi Nagai, born 1909, died 1951, leukemia.
John Sanford, reading from The Winters of That Country, the section called The Ugly Sky. Well, I want to begin by talking about political writing. In your case, it seems to me, although you have been blacklisted and you have been named as a communist writer, that this is humanitarian writing, not necessarily solely political writing. Do you define yourself as a political writer?
No, because I, although I was and still am a communist, I've never even read Das Kapital. I write because I have a feeling for the insult and injury to the earth, not because I'm told to by any party doctrine. I was more or less of a maverick as a communist anyhow.
How would you describe The Winters of That Country? Of the historical books, it certainly...
Commentaries on America.
It seems the most brutal of the four books.
I thought that I was consistently brutal.
Perhaps because the events are more recent, they seem to be more terrifying. But you don't feel that you trace a greater arc of inhumanity in the present tense?
In some of the earlier books, especially in A More Goodly Country, I didn't permit myself to go beyond the end of World War II. In Winters of That Country, as you can see, I went into the Vietnam War. And allowing myself to go further into the century and into the history of the country, perhaps in a way that was reflexive, and it reflected back on some of the earlier pieces that I did, and they got more vitriolic. That's the only way I'd explain it. Someone once commented that it was Dr. Mariani, who wrote a couple of introductions for me, that he wondered why I didn't go any further than the dropping of the bomb on Nagasaki. And I couldn't explain it, except that I felt that that belonged to a later generation to comment on what happened later. But in the winters, I did actually go into Vietnam. And as I say, it may have reflected back on the earlier pieces that I was writing in the book.
This is called Tales, subtitled Tales of the Man-Made Seasons. And of course, it's a chilling subtitle, considering that, you know, the earlier work had been about the brutalizing weathers that people find willy-nilly. These are man-made brutalities and our own responsibility. Could you comment on that?
It's the theme of all the books, really. And that's what surprises me when you say that this book seems to be more venomous than the others. Almost all of the things that I've written about in the historical commentary are man-made. This one happened to get named that as a subtitle. But I didn't actually feel that this had that effect.
Well, for instance, in the passage you just read, what amazes me is that there's, and I know that you're going to tell me that this is not something you intended, but you'll be grateful that I found it there. The passage about the flies, the great agony, is written as poetry, whereas the passage about the chrysanthemum is written as prose. And it seems to me in this particular case that the conventional role of poetry to celebrate the beautiful and the role of prose to enumerate the prosaic have reversed places here.
No, I simply felt that the particulars of the effects of the bomb simply just couldn't be rendered in prose. It couldn't even be presented. It had to have infinitely more rhythm. It had to have a different presentation and a different look on the page if it was going to have the effect that I hoped that it would have. And of course, the obbligato is the chrysanthemum. It's the obbligato to the atrocity. Now, I've written about the dropping of the bomb on more than one occasion. I've written about it even later than in the winters of that country. And again, I've used the method that I used here. On the other hand, in A More Goodly Country, which was my first writing about the bomb, it's much, much milder. It seems to me that it gets increasingly indignant, as it should.
I thought I'd offer listeners a contrast by asking you to read a piece now that's situated historically earlier about John Hawkins in the 16th century, called The Master of the Salamon, also from The Winters of That Country by John Sanford.
This is about John Hawkins, an English captain, 1532 to 1595, Master of the Salamon. In a public way of Plymouth, which is on the River Plym in the Shire of Devon, it befell that a certain John Hawkins, a youth of honorable descent, did openly and via armis assault a commoner, thereby causing a great effusion of blood with death resulting. Being hewed against by passers-by, he was made to stand his trial, whereat he deposed in manner following, "I struck the man," meaning one White, a barber, "because I could not avoid him. White had no first name, it seemeth, or if White was the first, no last. One White he was called, though, being half-christened, he might have been half-white. And it was thus that he quitted history, but questions remained in his train. A hum, as from a swarm come and gone. How had his life run out? Through the gorge, the gizzard, the privities? And had a weapon been used, or only the mortal empty hand? And what offense had he given? Had he shorn Hawkins' beard too short, or finding but down to work on, had he ventured a jest and laughed? I struck the man, said John Hawkins, because I could not avoid him, whereupon he was declared to be innocent of felony. Mariner and merchant became he now, and with such it was the custom to lade ware and woven stuffs, and sail it oversea for trade that promised gain. Beyond Cape Verde was a place where rarities were said to be displayed on the sands, as the teeth of elephants, and Malaguet pepper, and guinea grains, that pungent spice that some well named the grains of paradise. All these things could be got of the people there for such bait as hatchets, combs, nightcaps, and, more enticing still, copper and lead in a lump, to be beaten into earrings and omelets, manillos these last, that so delighted them. I struck the man, said he. He prospered in that commerce, but long did he long to traffic in one thing more that Africa afforded. Africanos, abundant they were and on display like goods and granules, black and blinding, a living kind of jet, and in time his mind was turned as once it turned for white. I struck the man, he said. He was 30 years old when his fleet of 3 sail stood out from Plymouth and cleared the sound. The flagship Salomon, 130 ton, the Swallow, 100 ton, and the 40-ton sloop, the Jonas. They made for Tenerife in the Grand Canaries. There they took on board the pilot Juan Martinez, a sailor much lauded for his knowledge of West Indian navigation. The next land raised was the coast of Guinea. I struck the man, Hawkins said, because I could not avoid... In the River Cases, he could not avoid taking 200 blacks from the Portingales, and in and about the River Matumbi, he could not avoid taking a like number from shore and ship, nor at Sierra Leone could he avoid laying hands on 500 more, to which were unavoidably added 32,000 ducats, a store of wax and ivory, and a certain great galleon for his 900 blacks. The hard spoil was sent to England. The soft went westward with the fleet. From Guinea, the winds and Juan Martinez took the merchandise to the Isle of Hispaniola, where at such ports as Isabella and Puerto de Plata and Monte Cristi, all Spain in Indies, awaited the cargo. When placed on view, bull and cow alike drew cries of admiration, for here were no Indian slaves, tameless Caribs or timid Tainos, that died too soon of broken hearts. These were fauna of another color, all of them lofty and well set, prime seed and likely breeders. They found much favor and fetched handsomely under the hammer. He made vend of the whole number of his negroes, for which he received in those three places, by way of exchange, such quantity of merchandise that he did only lade his own 3 ships with hides, ginger, sugars, and some quantities of pearls, but freighted also 2 other hulks with hides and like commodities. And so with prosperous success and much gain to himself, he came home and arrived in the month of September, 1563. The queen spoke Hawkins fair for his achievement. In recognition whereof, she granted the blackbirder a coat of arms after this fashion. Sable, on a point wavy, a lion passant or, in chief, 3 bezants, and for a crest, a demi-moor proper bound in a cord. No one had told her majesty that a slave ship stank from 3 leagues off. His feats, his fortune, his crest and coat of arms, sable on a point wavy, none of these things stayed the passage of time, and at 63 years of age the Queen's shipman died at sea. He was committed to it from the deck of the Garland, and even as one white, no man knows where he lies. I struck the man, death said, because I could not avoid him.
John Sanford reading the section called Master of the Salomon, from the winters of that country.
Poorly, I might add.
Well, this brings up a question, actually. You've, as far as I know, have never given public readings and rarely been interviewed. In fact, you've lived most of your life, in comparison with most writers, relatively isolated.
True.
What effect has this had on your work?
None that I know of, except that it's kept me free of infection. I haven't been influenced by their thoughts and by their styles. And I haven't been delayed by their palaver. Writers, when they get together, do an awful lot of talking. And I've been saved that. And furthermore, being alone, I've had the leisure to draw as deep from myself as I could possibly reach.
Now, this writing, these interpretations of American history, they are a hall of shame. And I wonder what the effect of this enumeration, this itemization, really of terrible guilt, what effect does it have on you as a writer to be living and writing about really the shame of mankind?
It's had a good effect on me. It's enabled me to speak my piece against what I think are the wrongs. And having done so, I feel that I've justified myself as a writer.
Do you feel that writers have an obligation, a social obligation?
Yes.
What is it?
I feel that they have to do what so many writers abjure, and that is they have to use it as a weapon, but they have to use it in an artistic way. I mean, they can't wind up their books by saying, "Man the barricades." It's got to be done as art.
What distinguishes art from propaganda? Can you give... I know that's an impossible question, but can you...
I won't even bother giving you an impossible answer. I can't answer that question.
How do you know, then, in your own writing, when you've achieved art and not propaganda?
You only know what you think you've achieved. You try.
Do you think, you've mentioned to me many times that that the works have not reached an audience which has nevertheless gone on to thrive nevertheless without it. Do you think that art has an effect, or is it merely the compunction of an engaged individual to write despite the fact of its lack of effect?
I think that ultimately it does have an effect. I don't believe that it has an immediate effect, of course not. It's cumulative. And over a long period of time, we absorb what the artists have tried to do. And they become a part of us, and they become part of our conduct, part of our beliefs. Otherwise, we have to believe that the world has made no progress whatsoever, and that art has played no part at all except to be decorative. I don't think that's so.
I'm going to ask you to read one last section. It's a section about Sacco and Vanzetti, also from The Winters of That Country.
Well, the heading says Alvin T. Fuller, 1878-1958, but the title is Rosina Sacco and Luigia Vanzetti. The epigraph is from Governor Fuller speaking on August 22, 1927. I can understand the sorrow that overwhelms you, but I can do nothing. The evening was well along when the two women were brought to his chambers in the State House. On being shown into his presence, they kneeled at once to beg him in Italian for the lives of their men, the brother of one and the husband of the other. Speaking through an interpreter, they implored him for more than an hour to spare the condemned men from death, awaiting them now in the next square of the calendar. Did he sit or stand for their pleas and prayers? Did he share their anguish and agonize too? Or did his mind stray from the sallow women to the sheen of his Gainsboroughs? Did he preen himself on his clubs, the Brookline country and the Union boat? did he gloat over his 40 millions, his summer place, his Back Bay stack on Beacon. Through an hour and more of supplication in two languages, was he ever once moved? Did he doubt his ground, however briefly, or did the sound he heard make him languorous, as if the water were running for his bath? Would the woman still be here for the voltaic moment? He may have wondered. Would Luigi be calling on him softly? Would Rosina be telling her beads? In the end, he had to end it, and he said, I can do nothing. And a mile away in Charlestown, a shoemaker and a fish peddler were as good as dead. At 1 minute before midnight, the governor left the building and betook himself where? To his summer place in New Hampshire? To one of his clubs, the Essex Country, the Algonquin? To a card game, a whorehouse, a saloon? He did not see the two women on the steps. He did not hear their weeping.
You've said at the time that you were so politically unaware as a young man that you did not know of Sacco and Vanzetti.
That's true.
What brought you to awareness?
Hearing their names for the first time. I was with a group of people who were aware. And I don't know what I was doing at the moment, but they were playing the radio, and it was along about midnight, and someone turned away from the radio saying, well, they burned them. I have that in one of the books. And I turned like a stupid innocent and said, burned who? And they looked at each other. Don't you know what's happening tonight, they said. And I said, no, what? And they said, you must be joking. You're a law student. In fact, you've passed your bar examination. You never heard the names Sacco and Vanzetti? I said, no. And one of them said, well, then you must be one stupid son of a bitch. It took me a little while, and I realized that I had been. And Sacco and Vanzetti have been an obsession with me ever since. I've written about them in almost every book that I've ever handled. They're in the most recent one. Twice, as a matter of fact. They were the pieces that Capra Press wanted me to remove, and I wouldn't.
Why would they, at this point, want them removed?
I suppose he figured that it would injure his sales. Who, he must have thought, would be interested in people called Sacco and Vanzetti in 1993?
It's amazing. I've been talking to John Sanford. We've been hearing sections from his book of interpretations of American history, The Winters of That Country. The book is still in print from Black Sparrow Press. To my mind, John Sanford is, you know, people always say, you know, one of the greatest living writers, but I don't think that living is a necessary addendum to that. I think that John Sanford writes some of the greatest prose that we've heard in America, and it really is American prose in that it is prose about the American conscience. Thank you very much for allowing me to spend time with you today, John.
Thank you.
This is Michael Silverblatt. You've been listening to Bookworm. My guest today was John Sanford. My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. I have a special debt of gratitude to Aris Janigian, who facilitated this interview. My engineer today here in Santa Barbara is Theo Mandel. Join me again next week on Bookworm.
To the jungles you can go in books. To the land of vices, go in books.
As you ramble through the pages, books will take you through the ages. Back to days of old when knights were bold and books.
Books, 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 books. Books. Books can be funny too.
Books make you laugh and sing. Books tell you everything. They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme.
Now it's book of the mouse clock time.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.